This is Sunday Morning Magazine, a weekly conversation highlighting topics and issues of value and importance to all the Northwest through the best medium of all, great stories and storytellers. Here's your host, Kate Daniels.
Good morning. I'm so glad you've joined me this morning when once again, I have the privilege of connecting with great women, and in this hour, we'll learn how they are impacting the lives of children. Michelle DeLino is the CEO and founding attorney of DeLino Family Law Group in Seattle. Michelle joins us to provide some insights into the role of a guardian ad litem in our court system. Michelle DeLino, good morning, and I really appreciate that we have this opportunity to have a good, important conversation.
Good morning. It's great to be here with you. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. What we're wanting to focus on, what I'd like to focus on, is what came to my attention. Something actually that was on my radar maybe 20 years ago, and I haven't really done anything further until today, and that is guardian ad litem. And what I have been reading from some of the information, reading about your firm and what's gone on in terms of Washington State, is not quite what I had in mind. So I'm really grateful that we can have this conversation to shed some light on this so that people who may and are using the system really have a better insight. So can you give us an overview of what the work of a guardian ad litem is?
Yeah, definitely. A guardian ad litem, I would say simply put, it's the only person in family court, the only person in the courtroom and in a family law case whose sole job is to focus on the child. That is their sole job. A guardian ad litem is typically either appointed by the court or agreed to by the parties and then appointed. It's somebody that does a custody evaluation. If you're in a divorce or a custody dispute and the parties aren't agreeing on what's going to happen with where the kids are going to live, guardian ad litem's job, their whole job, is to do what's best for the child and to try and stand in the shoes of the child, do an investigation, talk to all the parties. They do a number of things, and then they make a recommendation to the court on what the custody for this child should look like and what there's a lot of other things connected to that they make recommendations on. But it's really their job to take a neutral look. They are a neutral person and to try and do what's best for the child. I mean, attorneys are there advocating for their clients. Parties are there advocating for themselves. The court is trying to make decisions, but the guardian ad litem's whole job is to try and do what's best for the child. So that's actually a pretty unique and powerful thing.
And as I thought a couple decades ago when I first heard about this, I thought, yes, of course, it's so important that the child is represented for who they are and what's going on. However, now it seems that there are some questions being raised about how the system is really working. So, one of the questions I have is on who the guardian ad litem is. What are their qualifications? How do they get to be in this role?
That's a great question. And, you know, the background on guardian ad litems can be very different. A lot of people in that role, and it's a paid position, so they're being paid generally hourly, and they're being paid by the parties. They're typically not paid by the court. They're paid by parties that can afford to pay them. They charge a deposit, and people pay them. So they have to have qualifications, right? And many of them are attorneys. Many of them might be therapists with mental health backgrounds. Many of them might be former educators. They can have all kinds of backgrounds. And then they need to do a training. And so they go through training and they do what it takes. And then they are able to apply to be on a registry. And every county, like King County has a large registry. Snohomish County has a registry. Every county has one. And some are bigger than others. And you can be a guardian ad litem in multiple counties on multiple registries as well. But especially like in Seattle and King County, there's a lot of people, but there's a really high demand. So just doing the training and getting on the registry gets you there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're somebody that everyone wants to choose if you're not well known. So there's a lot of demand for the people that everybody do really want on their case. And those are people that have been doing this a long time and have had many cases and seen a lot of things, but their backgrounds can be really varied. And the training, that's kind of the issue. I don't think the training is enough. A lot of people don't think the training is enough, and it's not changing enough and adaptive enough to, you know, the needs of families, and it's not comprehensive enough. I mean, that's something I believe. I think that guardian ad litems do the best they can with the training that they have, but we probably need more. That's just the reality of it. We really do.
Need more training or more of them?
Both. I think we need both training and more of them that have a higher level of training and more experience. Cause you know, it's kind of a chicken and the egg problem though, right? Like you have to get experience, but people don't want to work with people that aren't experienced. So I think better training and, you know, more access to people that have more experience, maybe in a training capacity, could be a good way to go. Like, I think it would be great if you had to work with another guardian ad litem that has worked on 10 or 20 cases before you're able to handle one on your own. It's not that way now, but that would be something that I think would be good, because you could get somebody that doesn't really know and they have to have their first investigation, but how many people want to be that first investigation, right? So that's why we have a registry that's stacked with a lot of people, but everybody's still kind of, you know, wants to get what we call like the usual suspects, the people that everybody uses. Nobody wants the unknown. So that's another consideration. I think our system and the oversight of guardian ad litems, in addition to the training, that's probably what I think is really a big problem right now. I don't know if you've heard about that, I'm assuming.
Well, only because of this opportunity to have a conversation with you, that there was some investigation going on. So evidently... Something surfaced that required an investigation, or maybe there were several or a multitude of somethings.
Right. Yeah. And I would say, like, the system that we have for the oversight of this role, this is such an important role, right? Like, it's huge. It's important, and it's really bearing heavily on the outcomes for a lot of families. But what happens if it doesn't work, right? Like, the system, in a way, I wouldn't say it's broken, but it definitely has what I would call a structural gap. So the guardian ad litem, or GAL, as we often call them, that role works really well in a lot of cases, but when it doesn't, there's really nowhere to go, right? Other states have addressed this with pretty modest reforms. So some states have a registry for public complaints. They have an independent ombudsman. They have independent oversight, and they have clearer training standards. And these are not radical ideas, right? These aren't huge ideas, but these are small things that can be put into place. And they're basic oversight mechanisms that we expect in almost any other licensed professional program. But Washington just hasn't caught up yet. If you want to complain about the guardian ad litem, you're going to the court that they're working in all the time, and you're going to the court where your case is. And what if they don't, you know, I mean, that could create a real problem. And if they don't get, you know, disciplined or removed, or it could have a chilling effect on your case, and you're bringing concerns right back to the forum that they work in all the time. There's really no independent oversight. And that's a lot of what the investigation was talking about. Washington just hasn't caught up yet, but I think we could. I think there could definitely be a lot of opportunity for reform because these conversations are starting to happen.
So I read some of that report, and it dealt with a woman who, it seemed that the information was skewed, which seemed really unbelievable that that could be the case.
And that is very accurate. You can have these things happen where it's like, wow, did that really happen? Was that one-sided perspective really taken here? And it does happen. And that's unfortunate. But the thing is, guardian ad litems are people just like everyone else. They make mistakes. They might see something through the wrong lens. And I'll tell you what, like, most family law attorneys that I talk to, we genuinely respect good guardian ad litems, right? And we respect what they do. They're, like I said, they're often the only person there whose sole function is to focus on the child. So we really respect that. But the frustration isn't with the role itself, right? It's with the accountability and structure when something goes wrong and you have something like this where you're thinking, wow, they really got this wrong. And when that happens and something is wrong to the point that it is not just a, you know, maybe a question of opinion, but where something is really wrong in the investigation or the process, and you have nowhere to go. That's the frustration that family law attorneys and litigants are having, not with the role itself, because the role is super important. We have a ton of respect for it, and there's a lot of people doing it really well. But those times when it goes wrong, like in the investigation, then having somewhere to go and a way to deal with it, and also having publicly available information. So when people are thinking about, do I want this person working on my case, having more access to, has something gone wrong in the past, would be really helpful for families and attorneys in making decisions about selecting guardian ad litems and paying them, right?
Yes. And for the guardian themselves, you know, certainly they don't want to keep making the same mistake over again.
Right.
And the impact that it has, yes, on the adults involved, but the child. I mean, this is why they're there, is the child, yeah. and the, what is best for that child.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, they could be doing other things. It's like I said, you know, guardian ad litem usually, it's not a full-time thing for a lot of people. They might have a therapy practice. They might be an attorney. They might do other things, but they're doing this, I do believe, because they care about kids. I mean, you wouldn't be in this role if you weren't child-focused. You just wouldn't be. If the best interest of the child, which is the standard in Washington State and pretty much everywhere for what should happen in a parenting plan, if that wasn't something that mattered to you, you wouldn't be doing this. You would just be doing something else. So yeah, and that's kind of like earlier when you asked about the training. I think the training requirements can vary, and they aren't always up to date with what we know about child development and family dynamics, right? So in providing even more and more and more information and better training and better standardization that evolves every year, I think only helps these people that are here for the right reasons, right? They're here to help kids. So let's give them better tools to do that. Let's have accountability and let's give people more resources, because this is just a huge important thing, and it can really have a bearing on a child's future and a family, what that's going to look like. And parents, you can have parents that could be severely restricted from time with their children or making decisions because of guardian ad litem recommendations. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes they get it wrong.
Yes. And in terms of the training, is there then a certification that is
It's not actually a certification. It's they have to complete a training to be eligible to be on the registry. I don't know if I would call it a certification. I don't know if they actually get a certificate, but they have to complete the training to be qualified. And then they probably do get, you know, some kind of a certificate, but they have to actually be qualified to be listed on the registry. But what they have to do after that really isn't a lot. And that's the thing, is that every year more and more, you know, courts are looking at, and, you know, what informs them in making decisions about what's developmentally appropriate for children, what's appropriate in certain situations. It seems like guardian ad litem training really could teach more about family development dynamics and could be ahead of the game, really. And it's just not right now.
Right.
Yeah.
And in your experience then, as an attorney and family law, have you encountered that where there have been issues so that this is really touching something within you where you know the reforms needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say many times I've had many guardian ad litems do great jobs in my cases. I have a family law firm that has, you know, 16 other attorneys, and we have a lot of cases, and a lot of them have guardian ad litems. And for the most part, they do a great job. But I have seen cases where it doesn't go well. And maybe that's because the person just had the wrong opinion. Maybe it's because they discounted a lot of information. Maybe it's because they didn't have good enough training, for whatever reason it is. And then it really puts the burden back on either my client or the other party to have to then challenge that report and spend time and resources to do that. And it can be very difficult to unring that bell once the court has seen a report from somebody who's been appointed by the court saying all of these things. That can be a very stressful, costly, and difficult thing to undo. And I don't want to say that a guardian ad litem report is ever going to make all sides happy, because it's not. Someone's always going to be unhappy. And sometimes that's perfectly fine, and that's how it should be, you know. But other times, if something is so off and things in the investigation that's underlying that report is not sufficient, those are issues that need to be raised because it affects people's lives. So yes, I've seen it many times. And I don't think I've ever seen it where it's been, you know, overtly, I haven't seen anything, I think, that's risen to the level of some of the things in the investigation. Mm-hmm. But I know other people that have, and I do know other people too that have tried to challenge reports and tried to do different things about, you know, evaluating whether a guardian ad litem should be disciplined, and there's nowhere to bring that. And then they're stuck thinking, geez, do I want to bring it to this court where it could have an effect on future clients of mine or future cases of mine? And a lot of the times things don't get brought forward because there's not a forum to do it other than one that we're in every day.
So there is work being done already then to bring this to Washington State where there is a better oversight going on?
Yeah, I mean, Washington is actively exploring guardian ad litem reform, I mean, as of now, to address concerns of inconsistent training, lack of standardized qualifications, and biased reports. So there's proposed changes on it. Right now, I don't think there's anything that's actively in the legislature, but I think that that's probably what's coming next, and I certainly hope so.
Right. And just touching back to the report, which was by Investigate West, it
Right.
seemed that there was a case where there was, whether it was skewed information or inaccurate information, but it stayed present in the file so
Yeah.
that it really seemed to have an adverse effect on the mother in that case.
Yes, and that certainly happened, and that is what happens. And that's the problem, right? Because that information stays in the file. It's something that will follow that parent around for a long time to come. It will impact their current situation. It isn't going anywhere. It's not something that is all of a sudden going to be removed, right? The nice thing I think that people should know, and you shouldn't be scared of using a guardian ad litem in your case. You should want to. And I don't want to scare anybody away, because one thing to know is, yes, well, if they get it wrong, it can hurt you. It also is a very powerful tool for your family to have a neutral person looking at this. If you don't have a custody evaluator, like a guardian ad litem, and there's other types too, then you have a court who never sees your kids, never sees you outside of the courtroom, never has any time to do anything. And a guardian ad litem is going to meet your kids. They're going to come to your home. They're going to talk to counselors and therapists and people that you know. So don't be scared of it. It's a good thing. And my point of saying that in the first place was about the reports. The reports are filed under seal in the court. So the only people that have access to the full sealed report are, the court, the attorneys, and the parties. So don't worry that your whole family's history is going to be out there in a report, because that's not true. I mean, adverse findings are still a problem for your case, but I don't want people thinking that anybody, can just roll on down to the courthouse and get a report about you and your kids and very personal details. They are filed under seal, so that's a good thing. But overall, I still believe in the guardian ad litem process. I think it's really important for families. Courts want guardian ad litems because they don't want to make a decision about your kids without meeting them and knowing what's going on in a contentious custody case. So they serve a really important purpose. But the movement in Washington towards more training, better accountability is super important. So, I mean, I'm happy to have a chance to talk to you about that. I'm glad you asked.
So that's wonderful news, important news that this is actually happening. Do you feel that there will be some momentum with this, or do these things kind of really struggle along?
Here's the thing about the legal system in general. Things take time. It's slow, slow, slow. It's slow to see change. It's slow to see reform. But even beginning to have the conversation, I think, is really promising. And the Investigate report, and Washington's not the only state, obviously, struggling with these issues. There's a number of states that are. But I think it might take longer than we want, but I actually do think we'll get there. I think there's important conversations being had, and I think it's too big of a part of the family court system now that it's being talked about to just be ignored. So I think we'll get there. It'll take longer than we want, but we'll get
Well, that feels optimistic, hopeful.
there.
So that's definitely a plus.
Yeah.
In terms of families choosing a guardian ad litem, and there is a registry, do they get to interview them, or are they just reading bios on their computer?
Yeah. They're really not interviewing them. Most of the time, somebody that's selecting a guardian ad litem has an attorney. And because they're paying for it, they have an attorney. Sometimes one party might not, or maybe the parties don't, but they don't have the resources for a guardian ad litem. They're probably utilizing something like family court services or CASA. And both of those are typically utilized by lower income families, not always, but most of the time. And those evaluations are like CASA is volunteer driven, so they're not paying for that, but the investigation is not necessarily as in-depth. And family court services is an appointed service. So people that have guardian ad litems typically have an attorney making a recommendation on who to pick. So that's helpful. But if you don't, pretty much what you're looking at is the registry that says, okay, how many cases have they worked on? How long have they been on the registry? And then there's usually a CV giving their background. But that's it. You're not interviewing anybody because they don't want you to have, one-sided communication with the guardian ad litem even before the case starts. It has to be very neutral. So the guardian ad litem isn't going to call you up and chat with you and be like, let me tell you all about me, because then you potentially are connecting with them in a way that's not appropriate given their role. So it's really tough. And having an attorney say, hey, I've used this person a bunch of times and they're super fair and they're a good way to go, that's really valuable for clients too, but not everybody's in that position. So having a registry, at least to know if this person's been disciplined, would be helpful. More about their background would be helpful. Just beyond the basic, here's the one pager on the court website. And that, we don't have that right now.
Right. And when you were just sharing that, Michelle, you mentioned CASA. That rang my bell. Like that was the conversation I had way back when, and was thinking in terms of volunteers. And of course, that's what CASA has.
Yeah.
In some ways, there must be some funding, but still, that was volunteer driven in terms of the guardian ad litems.
Yeah, CASA stands for Court Appointed Special Advocates, and it's an amazing organization. There's an annual, it is funded largely by donations. There was a large CASA luncheon downtown at the Westin just a few weeks ago that a lot of family law attorneys and community comes to. People donate. There's a presentation about what CASA does. That's an annual thing. And CASA is great. There's an income cap on CASA. I believe right now, I think it might be $100,000 if you have a combined income of both parties of that amount, which isn't a lot in King County. So, you know, but you are eligible to use somebody as a court-appointed special advocate, and they are a volunteer. And so, you know, they're going to do the best investigation they can. It's going to be different than a guardian ad litem investigation because of the time involved and so on and so forth. But CASA is super important. And I think it's a program that serves a lot of families very well that can't afford a guardian ad litem. So,
and are there attorneys, though, who volunteer for CASA?
There are. There are attorneys who are CASA volunteers. There's sometimes people, paralegals, other people involved in the legal system. Law students sometimes will volunteer with CASA if they're interested. A lot of people can volunteer with CASA. Really, anybody can that wants to devote the time. And I think it's a very worthwhile organization.
As all of this is, because again, we're focusing on the children, and that can't be overstated in terms of really advocating for the best possible circumstances for their lives. So, and that's what you, of course, do also day in and day out, I'm sure, with family law.
We try. Yeah, we really try. I mean, at the end of the day, family law is a difficult practice area. I always say that nobody leaves a divorce a winner. So if you're coming into a divorce or a custody battle thinking that you're going to win, it doesn't really work that way. You know, you come out wanting to find the best in a new normal for you and your family. And if you have children, you really should be focused on loving your children and wanting what's best for them more than hating or trying to make things difficult for your former spouse. So the focus on kids is what we really try to tell people to do when they're in tough spots. But, you know, it's an emotionally charged situation with people at their worst moments. And I think keeping the focus on children it's one thing that I think everybody in the process can usually agree on.
Well, great. thank goodness for that.
That's
most of the time.
Of the time. Yeah.
We know there are those little marginal areas where
there are.
Yeah. But your experience, you know, you're choosing family law. You certainly had some sense that it would have these challenges, and yet you've pursued it and you have a huge firm here in Seattle.
I do. Yeah. I started in criminal defense, actually, in criminal law. And that was what I was really passionate about. But then I realized very early on in my practice that criminal law is more transactional. Somebody gets arrested, they have a DUI, they have whatever, and it's a transactional relationship between attorney and client. And I realized what was more interesting to me was the fact that these people, they all have families and there's a whole other thing going on. And there's tension and issues in a family almost anytime someone's affected by being charged with a crime. And it made me start to think about things differently and start to think about the bigger effect rather than just solving this one little problem for a client in the court system. There's a bigger picture going on. So that's kind of how I got into family law. And I've been in family law now for almost off and on since the very beginning, almost 17 years. So, yeah.
I love that larger perspective. Let's kind of, you know, treat some of the situations so we prevent potential problems going on.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people tend to usually come to us when things are, you know, have already happened, but it doesn't always have to be that way. There's things that you can do, whether it's, especially you can't do a parenting agreement ahead of time before you get divorced, like if in anticipating a divorce, but you can do things like prenuptial agreements, cohabitation agreements. People can plan for their family's future with estate planning. They can do a lot of things proactively to provide more security to their families. Family law isn't always just about divorce and dealing with that. That's a big part of it, but there are other aspects of family law that allow us to kind of be forward-looking, which I really like.
Oh, and that's an interesting thing that you mentioned then about the prenups. Mm-hmm. You know, I know so little about it, but my bias, I guess, is, oh, it's all about the money. But no, mm-hmm. it sounds like there can be those agreements about having children, how that all then transpires. Is that right?
In a way, you can't decide in a prenup like what the custody is going to look like. But a prenup is really, I think the attitude towards prenups has changed over the years. And some people will even do postnuptials after they've already been married, or they'll do cohabitation agreements. And the way that really is a bigger picture thing is that you are saying, look, if this relationship doesn't work out, if this marriage doesn't work out, and there's unfortunately a very high chance these days that it won't, what will happen is all of our assets and who pays for what will all be decided based on what the law in Washington is. And with a prenup, you're really saying, no, we have enough love and respect for each other that we're going to decide what the terms are going to be and not leave that to chance. It's like an insurance policy. You don't drive around with liability insurance because you're planning on hitting somebody. You drive around with that insurance. So if you do, it doesn't financially destroy you and your family. And that's very much the similar way with a prenup. And you anticipate and have to have hard conversations about money and what your family plan is going to be, because we will always talk about, is somebody going to have, are you likely to have kids? If you do, is somebody going to stay home and take care of them? What is the financial support then going to look like for that person that does? And so we get to kind of problem solve ahead of time and think about things that might happen. And it leaves a lot less to fight about if things don't work out, and hopefully things do. And you've had a chance to really talk about what that framework's going to look like for you. So I think it can only be a good thing. And a prenup also too, it's not like just a rich person's thing. It's not about what you have. It's about the life you're going to build together. It's about the wages you are going to earn. It's about, you know, the decisions you're going to make. It's not just about someone coming in saying, I want to protect this pile of money. It's about what's the life cycle of your relationship going to look like as it relates to finances in your family. It's a bigger discussion.
It sounds like a really important, practical discussion.
It is.
It's not
it
all
really
about
is.
The gown and the parties and yeah. you know, the big dinner or whatever. It's yeah. like, no, this is like day-to-day life, what that's going to be.
Yeah.
Very,
100%.
Very, yeah, sounds yeah. great. Well, you yeah. Sound so reasonable and practical and really invested, obviously, in the kind of work that you are doing and that you want to share that. So I really yeah. appreciate your taking time with us this morning. Michelle, let's mention a website that people yeah. might feel intrigued by what we've talked about.
Totally. Okay. Yeah. If you want to find out more, if you want to connect with us, you can find us online at delinolaw.com. It's DELLINOLAW.com. You can find me all over the place. You can find me on Instagram, on TikTok, on Threads, on pretty much any social media platform. Me and the law firm are there. If you look for me, we're there. I love to talk to people about these issues, about what's going on in our community. And, you know, Kate, I really appreciate you having me on to talk about this today. It was great to connect.
Wonderful to connect. And really, I've learned so much more, and I trust others listening have the same experience. So thank you for your time and for your contributions to our community and to the world, Michelle.
Oh, thanks, Kate. And thanks for being here.
You've been listening to Sunday Morning Magazine. Tune in every Sunday at this time to hear great stories and insights from difference makers throughout the greater Northwest. Stay tuned in just a moment for Inspirational Women.